This is Richard Roth, and this show is The Passage. That was The Psychedelic Furs with High Wire Days. If there's anybody who knows about playing on the high wires, it's my guest today, the artist Lucio Pozzi. Lucio's had a studio in Hudson for decades. He shows at BCB Art on Lower Warren Street and at the Hudson Opera House, and also in New York and in Europe. I'll let Lucio speak for himself. Lucio, welcome to WGXC.
Hello, very nice to be here. Thank you.
Now, when did you first come to Hudson?
More than 30 years ago, I was using a house in Germantown, and I met a real estate guy who told me there was a warehouse for sale for very little money, and I should absolutely buy it. At the time, I was one of the early settlers in what became to be called Soho in New York. And I told him I definitely don't need space. But he said, look, this is so inexpensive that you should rebuy it. So I paid a very small fee every month for 30 years and got this tremendous warehouse in Hudson. And thank God I got it, because as I was cost to downsize in New York, I had a place where to put my stuff. And meanwhile, I became enamored with Hudson and its people. And I come here as often as I can. Actually, now I'm living a lot in Italy, but I think I have dual sites. I have two studios, one in Hudson and one in Valeggio, which is a little town near Verona in Italy. I come as often as I can. In my mind, I would come 2-3 times a year. Recently in Europe, I've been more busy than I expected with activities, so now it's a long time I've not been here. And today there's wonderful weather, and to be here makes me doubly nostalgic.
You've certainly seen changes over the years.
Yeah, Hudson has changed radically. When I came, no one wanted to be here. There were a couple of pioneering artists, like Jeffrey Wasserman, who had taken a whole floor, a former brothel, some top floor, and some building in Warren Street. And I had this rickety warehouse, which had soil on the floor, and a few other people. There was Friedel Zubas, who I had known in New York a long time ago. And I think later on, Arschwager came here also. But many people came later. And at the time, I considered this warehouse of mine as just a deposit. And then I began to paint in it, and I began to put up a wall, and then pour some concrete on the floor, and I became a very important feature in my life.
There was something about the town that appealed to you even then?
Yeah, immediately. The architecture and the life, the fact that there was a coherent culture here, it appealed to me. I met people whom I really liked, and it was a kind of life that became a rich alternative to the life I was living in that which became Soho. Soho became kind of frantic, and art became more and more of a business together, linked to real estate. And Hudson became to be a little bit what I had found in the early 60s when I landed in New York. Art was an emulation. It was not a competition at the time. I first lived in the Lower East Side, and there were whole buildings of drug addicts. Others that were of Ukrainians were beginning to move out to Queens, and then there were buildings with new immigrants from Puerto Rico or the Caribbean. And then there were buildings with artists. And that community was rich in contrast and exchange. Many friends that I knew then had developed big careers in the world, maybe at a little bit at the expense of their art. Some of them have started making art that's more standardized. But at the time, it was very rich, very stimulus. It was very stimulus. It was a big stimulation to the thought and to the practice of art.
That was before Soho even kind of became an artist center.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah.
And then you moved to Soho in the 60s.
As many artists, I'm always looking for spaces that are not expensive and big enough. So at one point, my then wife and I moved from loft to loft until we found bigger lofts. And then the opportunity came to get together with some other people to buy a building, and so we went through the routine of buying the building, and meanwhile, Soho became bigger and bigger, more and more commercial, until galleries and artists were kicked out or bought out, and boutiques came in, or rich people who like to live in lofts.
Now, what specifically have you seen changing about Hudson?
Well, it has become gentrified to a degree. It has followed in a certain way the Soho pattern. You could call Hudson now the Soho of New England, but it has kept more of its identity. And there's a more of a mixture of art, researches of the intellect, and the arts and crafts. So I feel that there is, people come here, often they leave big cities, you know, to be more in touch with their own body and the physicality of life. And Hudson is surrounded by a very beautiful countryside. It has a river, which also New York has, but in New York you forget about it. Well, here instead, you know, it's here as a mythical entity. So Hudson, I think, is gentrified, but is not being ruined.
Do you find that you produce a different kind of work when you're in Hudson than you would in, say, in New York or in Italy?
In hindsight, I would say yes, but frankly, I don't know what happens. But I think that I like to paint, especially, and painting has the unconscious or the preconscious area of one's thought is in touch with the surroundings, and it's inevitable the context seeps into the brushstrokes that you use, even when you think you are doing something which is exactly the same as what you are doing in New York or in Italy. You actually, some connotations change. I'm sure of that, but I would not be able to tell you which.
You were a teacher for many years.
Yeah. Teaching was my way to insert myself in the city. When I first came, I took a small loft on 2nd Avenue and 4th Street with a friend of mine who then became also my brother-in-law for a while. And he's the Italian-Moroccan painter Mohamed Melehi. And we had this little place. There was sculptor Lyman Kipp in the same building and the painter Jim Dine. And just happened, we stumbled upon this place and we started painting. And so I went around with my slides. And galleries in New York were different than they are now. They were maybe a little more provincial. And I started from the big galleries, and very many of these galleries told me to go to such and such a gallery because there they show Italians. So I resented this very deeply. But meanwhile, I understood that the place was a little close to me. So from Italy, I had met people like David Land and Wolf Kahn, who were teaching at Cooper Union, and I told them that I would love to start teaching a little bit, which would be a way for me to become more part of the community. And at one point, David Land told me, you know, there's a place to be the historian of art and architecture at Cooper Union, and would you like to apply for it? Because you're not known as a painter, and you're too young, and so maybe they wouldn't give you any painting teaching. So I started, I said, I'm not an art historian, you know. He told me, this time the ethnic remark was positive, you're an Italian, you know more than many. So I was very naive and wonderfully irresponsible. I was 26, 27 years old. I prepared, they asked me to do a lecture to a very giant auditorium, which they showed me. And being a very shy and retiring person, I was terrified, really. But anyhow, I prepared the lecture that I knew was my test. And I did a lecture on, I compared the life and attitudes of Duchamp and Giorgio Morandi. I discovered they were more or less born the same year, and they died more or less the same year, and they were obviously the two extremes at 180 degrees, that bracket the whole modern movement in the 20th century. So I did this lecture and with two screens, and the day of the lecture, I didn't even know how to pronounce certain words. I'd asked friends how to pronounce, and I gathered all kind of jargon from magazines. I did everything I could to really compensate for my basic ignorance. I had just, still have, only a high school degree. So I came to this lecture hall prepared to talk to 200 people. And there was the dean, the director of the program, one student, and the projectionist. So my terror increased. And I decided to talk to the empty chairs as if there were people there. That actually was my first experience in performance. At the time, no one called them performances, but it was my first thing, my first attempt to theatricalize my delivery. And I gave this lecture, and I got myself hired. I was hired illegally. I was a tourist. I had a tourist visa. And anyhow, they called me a consultant. At the time, the immigration service and was more lax than now, maybe. And I started teaching history of art and architecture for the whole of Cooper Union. Now, you must realize, I did not know what Cooper Union was. I know it was an old school. I did not realize it was the oldest academy in the States. And it had a status that was above and beyond most of the art schools. And so I started teaching history of art and architecture to students who, being the student body very qualified there, were often ahead of me in their knowledge. I stopped painting, frankly. I wanted to teach about the modern movement, and I found a bookstore called Wittenborn's where the young clerk knew a lot about history, and Cooper Union had none of the books that could be useful, nor did it have slides that could be useful for my course. So this young clerk, somehow, and I concocted my course. I was always a week ahead of the students, and I delivered these lectures to the whole of Cooper Union, and I didn't sleep anymore, and basically Cooper Union gave me my degree in without my having studied in a school. And from there, at one point, it fired me because I think I had done a performance called 29 Nudes Descending the Staircase, and this had caused a certain scandal. My performance came out on the Village Voice under the title Nudes at the Cooper Union, then came out in Playboy and came out all over the world, and I think the Cooper Union authorities were a little annoyed by this. So at one point they told me they had to save, they had to reduce their budget, and I lost my job. At the time I was beginning to show at the John Webber Gallery in New York, and the assistant there told me that there was some teaching possibility at School of Visual Arts, so I started teaching there. By the way, because my lectures of history of art were theatricalized in order to cover my ignorance, and so enthusiastic about my beliefs in modernity, and not in modernity, but in the way modernity had developed, I had finally gotten a studio teaching class. And then they made an art history department, and I ceased being the sole historian of art and architecture for the whole Cooper Union, and I was able to switch to that which I liked more. Anyhow, I left Cooper Union with School of Visual Arts. I began to also exhibit nationally and internationally, so I began to do lots of teaching. I began to do visiting artist stints here and there, and found myself in Princeton, Maryland Institute. I did a whole series of visiting artist situations in California. I went around a lot. I tell my students that they should always jump without parachute. So I did my jumping without parachute. In naivete and just distraction, I find myself in complicated situations sometimes and then cope gladly.
Now, all this time you also were doing painting and performance art.
Yeah, it started, I had a couple of exhibitions in Italy as a New Yorker, and then at my first exhibition in John Webber, it was an exhibition in two parts. One was called Paintworks, and the other one was called Photoworks. And this was in 1972. I began to think very much about the context of painting, which is my field of concern, the placement, even the gallery, not take the gallery for granted, but take it as a context that affects the work of art where it is being thought and made without often the painter or the artist even knowing it. But anyway, I started thinking of those things. So I started thinking also of how painting translates in other media. That's why I did a show of photo works together with a show of paint works. There were two separate shows in 4 months away from one another. And so I began to think very much of the theory and the practice of painting and how to locate it, and started already immediately then becoming very, very fed up with the criteria and conventions that guided art making and art viewing. So with John Weber, I began to examine all these things. I studied already, actually, now that I remember, I studied the year before in Milan. I found myself showing an exhibition that showed Americans. And at the time, I was showing monochrome paintings, red monochrome paintings of various sizes and various shapes. And I began to hear many people who came to tell me that painting is dead, which is something which is a recurring motif of modernity. It started around the late 19th century, and like the business cycle, every 7 or 8 years, some people declare painting to be dead. And sometimes, out of this, they make very good art, or very interesting art. Anyhow, in reaction to this, I'd heard of a certain Joseph Beuys, who in Germany was doing actions. So there was a storefront that was empty near this gallery where I was showing my red paintings. And I said, listen, why don't we do some things there, some actions there, some things that are extensions of painting. So I did all kinds of activities that referred to the red paintings, in as much as there was always a red something in these things I did. Some were of the kind that later on became called performances, and some were of a kind that later on became called installations. At one point, after the second one, though, I was arrested by the police because I did a shootout in this storefront, and some neighbor complained that I was disrupting the peaceful life of the shopping road where this gallery was, and I was arrested, and then I could not continue. I continued in the gallery with some activities in the courtyard.
I think maybe you'd better explain what was meant by shootout.
Yes, okay. I don't want to put in too many words. I hope you edit a little bit this conversation later on.
Yes.
Because I get carried away and then I get afraid of saying too many things. The shootout was, I stood in this shopping street, one of the most elegant shopping streets in Milan, telling passers-by. I would tell them, ladies and gentlemen, please come in. Every half hour and a half hour, there will be a killing. With them came three young actors, a woman and two men, and I was translating my viewing in the gallery. I thought people in the gallery where the red paintings were would be walking from side to side of these paintings and perusing them from near and from far in order to discover the subtleties that might articulate the surface. And the meaning of these paintings was definitely not verbalizable. And I thought of translating these paintings into its opposite. So when people came in, I put them behind a white line. So instead of moving, they were not moving. And with them came the three actors, also stood behind the white line. At the half hour, exactly on the half hour, two of the actors in turn would arrest the third one, drag her or him to the end of this empty store, and then remove themselves, withdraw to a certain degree, and then shoot this person with a blank gun. This person had a red carnation in his or her hand to refer to the red paintings next door and would then die. And then the killers would come and get the corpse and carry the corpse to the back of the storefront. It was not a storefront, it was a big store. And then come back with a broom and clean. And of course, the symbolism of what the discrete paintings were in one room and the symbolism of this very high contrast echoing shocking event in the other room, and the contrast between the two was of course something one could develop lots of thought about. But anyhow, the word spread that Lucio Pozzi was doing paintings but also was available to do actions, and then later they became called performances. At the time in the 70s, I found myself traveling all over the world with my paintings, and at shows everywhere, and somehow every time I was asked to do some performances. And so I started developing a repertory of performances even, and installations also. Always referred to my painting, though. The reference point, the matrix, is always painting. So I began to have fun doing that, and began to discover more and more about myself, my emotions, my thoughts. And of course I was not alone doing this. There were many friends who did the variations in art, but most of them ended up specializing. Some people became only performers, other people became only installation artists, other people became only painters, and somehow they ended up even criticizing one another for whatever they were specializing at. And so by intuition then, and now well aware of it, I began to realize that all this specialization did not belong to the bustling, revisable, constantly changing dynamics of our society. And art was losing more and more of its agreed-upon purposes, and therefore I began to follow the very simple theory of what if, why not, and began to do things. Oh, I forgot to say before, all this that I was doing somehow gelled when Alana Heiss began to organize shows of her friends and the artists around who dealt with art in a way that was similar to mine, in the Clock Tower and then PS1. PS1 somehow made me understand exactly what I meant all these years by considering the environment and the context of painting as part of it. So I had already said that my painting is not a picture hanging on the wall, but a wall activated by painting, by a painted surface. PS1 somehow made it very clear to me. I was one of the very few painters there. Most of the people were environmental artists or sculptors. And PS1 was a basic experience. So when I came to Hudson and someone showed me the Hudson Opera House and asked me if I would want to do something there, there were the peeling walls, and then there was some leftover furniture from whatever had been there before and piles of junk. And my PS1 instinct immediately revived. And I got very enthusiastic about what I could do there. So I asked if I could use the whole opera house, and I did a series of installations. I brought some installations of mine from before, and then did some new things. I found, for instance, a golden frame, and by framing a part of a wonderful peeling wall with all its colors, all the layers of paint showing through it, I made a wonderful Baroque picture, texture picture. And I arranged the smashed computers that were piled in a room into, I think, an interesting sculpture. Occasionally I added some paint to what I was doing. So in Hudson I did that, and then I did a photo work for the window. And then what performance? I did reading in the news is something that I've done now 4 or 5 times, and I did it in Hudson. I come to a place, and I gather all the press of that place from that week. I sit on a chair, and I put all the printed matter on the floor, and I have 4 hats that are in the 4 colors, the banal colors that I like to color code what I do with, red, yellow, blue, and green. I have them under the chair, and I have some grapes and some water. And then for 8 hours, I like to do 8-hour performances that started in Milan in 1971 when I did the series I was mentioning before. I read the news aloud, and when someone comes in, I start reading the news. I read anything that I find, advertisements, obituaries, marriage announcements, political news, chronicles, whatever. And I read it aloud, very calmly. The only device that I use is that instead of using the names that I find printed in the press, I use only 2 names. For every man's name, I use the name John Smith, and from every woman's name, I use the name Mary Jones. So a very awkward averageness of life comes from this, and it can be quite entertainment for whoever comes to listen to me to stay there for a few minutes and see what comes. It's a little bit bewildering. I started in Milan doing performances that last office hours, 8 hours. I still do them. It's what everyone does. So I want to see what happens if you make art during office hours. There's a routine. Of course, it's a tease because people who are bound to go to the office from 9 to 5 don't have the leisure that an artist has in performing for 8 hours.
Recently, you've been curating shows.
I occasionally curate shows. I curated a show at John Weber's in the 80s, I think, called In Between, which was a show that regarded art that would be difficult to classify. it would be in between categories. There were mostly objects and painted matters and some word works, but there was always this undefinable characteristic to the art, which is what I'm very keen on finding. I'm very afraid for the artist and for the culture at large when I see something that's too easily classified and categorically secluded in its own corral. So this show in between was an interesting experience. I mixed there many artists who then eventually also have done some careers that were maybe a little less in between than when they started. And recently in the village where I live near Verona in Italy, I found a big Art Deco style building from 1938, which has abandoned. And inside it, there were walls that were painted in different colors because it had been a showroom for a furniture store. And again, my PS1 instinct came alive, and the space was tremendous, so I thought I'd put a dozen of artists there, and I knew a couple of galleries in Verona whom I could ask to borrow some pieces from. And I started putting together the show until the Art Fair of Verona adopted it as a part of its collateral events, and the show became much bigger than I expected. It was a show of 28 artists, Americans and Italians, and who worked in all materials. It was a very interesting experience, but as you, Richard, know, to create a show takes lots of time, so I have been a little less in my studio this past 2 months than I expected.
Do you have any plans to come and spend longer periods of time in Hudson?
I dream of coming for a very long time here. I plan already this past 2 years to spend half the year here and half the year in Italy, but somehow in Europe I got myself involved in many more performances, installations, shows, and activities of one kind or another than expected. So I've not been able to come to Hudson as much as I wish. I hope next year to come for a long period of time. Also, my studio is in really needs reordering, and I need to paint on some of the canvases that I started years ago. And I would like to finish them, and I want to be here also. A little part of my American soul. After all, I'm now a citizen since decades, and my whole life is formed in the States. So even though my soul is in the middle of the Atlantic between Europe and America, I want to cultivate the American part of my thoughts and my sensibilities, and to come to Hudson would do that. So I hope very soon to come back for a long period of time.
How would you like art to develop here?
My wish is for art things to always be at the beginning. One of the words that I dread that's used often about art is when they say of an artist or of an organization. Of an artist especially, he or she has found his or her own. To find one's own is to me like to be mummified. So I hope that Hudson, which is a community which is large now and it goes beyond the borders of the city itself, and I hope Hudson will never find its own, really. And so be very alive, constantly in the beginning, constantly with possibilities of transgressing. And I hope there will be more and more activities that reach out to the various communities in the region. For instance, I don't know, I can ask you, have there been presentations of food or clothes or art or literature made by the Bangladeshi community of Hudson?
There are food, definitely.
Good, good. Because this is a multi-ethnic and multicultural community, and I hope that it can cultivate all its roots.
There are Bangladeshi shows on this radio station, and Haitian Creole and Spanish
Good.
Language.
Well, so I hope also in the arts, though, this will happen, and I hope that the talents that I'm sure many people have around can be shown and shared, because I'm sure there's very much talent around. It can be probably very, very enriching to exchange gazes with and words with. I'm sure there are poets in all these communities. And Hudson would be the ideal center to cultivate this. I hope also that a very important part of urban life is fostered here, which is interesting, intelligent. As a book published by Yale years ago said, intelligent planning for change. So to plan on one hand, and to be able to also change on the other hand. So it seems to be an oxymoron, but instead I hope that Hudson will develop a community that will allow itself to grow in terms of urban planning and studies of the density and the interaction between the different cultural forces from very many levels. I know that the artist David Deutsch is involved in this here, and I hope that people like him are encouraged to continue and to persist and will receive support, because I think that activity could create also in the more discreet arts, like the visual arts, a wave of energy that can make Hudson a really interesting point of alternative to the institutionalization of art exchange in big cities like New York.
There's been quite a bit of controversy lately about how the waterfront should be developed.
All American cities had waterfronts that were used only functionally, only in a utilitarian manner. Now it's around 30 years that the factories and the functional buildings that are built on waterfronts are beginning to be rediscovered as industrial archaeology and as potentially interesting volumes and spaces to work with in a creative way, which goes beyond the original function. So Hudson probably has that possibility now. I don't know what the controversy is here. I know there is controversy. The best thing is to get a bunch of good architects and town planners who are going to understand how to enrich the waterfront in a way that does not become a cold boutique gentrification that brings life to it, but it also does not become a touristic exploitation spot. It's a very difficult problem to approach. It takes some good minds to put themselves together on that. Like in New York, what is called the South Seats Threepole was done by a good architect, if I remember. But with all the best intention, it has become a mass tourist spot, which is maybe not as articulated as it could be.
The question here is whether there should be any industrial activity at all down there. They haul some limestone from the mountaintop and load it onto barges, which requires that trucks go through the town and or get there somehow.
Does it have to be on this waterfront, or can it be moved 100 yards or a mile?
Well, there's a deep water dock there now, and it's under private ownership.
Do you remember Brave New World by Aldous Huxley? Do you remember that people, as a prize, would be given a trip to the wilderness, where I don't know if they call them savages or primals, whatever they were called, are kept in their primal life. They were still hunters and gatherers, and they were not wearing clothes. And the people from the advanced, quote-unquote, world would go there to watch them. Basically, the whole Amazonia, I think it was placed there, was a zoo. So one has to be very careful not to involve oneself in boutique planning. On the other hand, if you keep the industrial activity there, it will become part of boutique. Let's look how the rough and tumble really happens. So I don't know how to give you an advice. My instinct is to integrate all the levels of life. When I was studying architecture, which I never studied to the end, but I studied a little bit enough to get the brushing of it. I remember we were very excited in the late 50s about the English new towns, where they tried to integrate all the activities and all the ages. For instance, the square was imitated, the pedestrian square imitated from the Venetian squares, and retirement homes were put next to schools of different ages, and traffic was conveyed around there so that there would be access from all sides. And English new towns did not succeed very well. They were overplanned. So I stumbled upon this book, Designing Cities for Planning and Change, that is, the contradictory forces of planning and change, which would allow the dynamic of life to move on, not to get prescribed. That remains as my ideal. If I was involved in thinking about these things, I would put my energy towards using Hudson as an opportunity to a step forward. And first thing you people should do here, or we people should do, since I'm a resident here, today I went to vote, what we people should do is to really pull our sleeves up and look nationally and internationally who are the architects who are really involved with different theories of architecture and regional planning that goes from the nail to the whole network. So architects who think about society and aesthetics as being integrated forces that have to be involved also with the economics and the dynamics of real life. First, to find who the people are around, maybe in India, maybe in Portugal, maybe in Paraguay, maybe in Albany, who are thinking in a way that would integrate different levels of life. And then began to have a conference with these people, which would actually bring publicity, because also many architectural people who are involved in architecture would attend to and publicize it well, and then begin to think about how can planning coincide with change, how can utilitarian activity be integrated with pure speculation. It's a major modern problem. It's a major contemporary problem. It affects the whole world. I mean, there are wars being fought now because we didn't think sufficiently about this stuff. So Hudson could be a good opportunity to start. I'm sure there are people who do it somewhere else. But first, let's see who does it, where, how did it go, if they started 10 years ago, what were the results, and start gathering information and pulling our sleeves up. It could be an exciting, very exciting opportunity.
There are certainly plenty of examples in towns on the river as you go toward New York that have done bad planning.
Yeah, you cannot plan the aesthetics, because there's always disagreement about aesthetics. But you can plan volume, and you can plan distribution and traffic, pedestrian and mechanical traffic. Very many conditions can be thought about. When we talk about planning, we still consider planning in a way that's late 19th century planning, like something that should bind us. Instead, real planning is articulated and dynamic. Real planning gives opportunities. Like even economically, if I understand it correctly, they are the ones who believe in rampant freedom and the ones who believe in strict planning. And they both are wrong. And from the very little I understand in economics, there was a gentleman called John Maynard Keynes who has developed a way to integrate the two. And he often is being fought by the right and by the left. And in the arts, I think in planning towns, which is definitely an artistic endeavor, collective artistic endeavor, there should be a Keynesian way of approach that through incentives and through some borderlines, but flexible borderlines, can foster a constant growth and a bustle of contradictions also. Contradictions are very important. Contradiction should not be resolved. It should be lived. Hudson has the opportunity. It's at that stage of development. Enough people from outside having come in, enough people who were born here staying here, enough cultures merging here, Hudson has the real opportunity now to become a pilot a pilot case. Will Hudson catch it? I don't know. When I lecture about myself, my lecture is called, I've given it in three languages all over the world. It's called The Next 475 Years of My Art and Life. So maybe one day I will deliver it here in Hudson. And so you will see that there's so much to say, because now I've lived 75 of these years, but the next 475 years never changes the title. It's the same title since 35 years. So there's still 475 years to live. So there are 475 years of these conversations of ours to continue. And I hope we can resume it again and again.
I hope so, too. And I hope I hope we will see some art shows.
Well, maybe soon it will come. My warehouse is full of art. Much of it has been exhibited, but very much has not been exhibited. And when there are spaces available, I'm very excited about doing things. Actually, I have a project that I started in my studio and then could not find anywhere to show it, which has to do with painting on the wall certain shapes and hanging certain found shapes in wood next to them that maybe I will do here sooner or later. That would be exciting, but so much to do.
Well, thank you very much for coming in and talking.
Well, this was great, as usual. Thank you.
Thank you.
Often touch, keep it alive. much, I was digging me so much, I dug myself right into a hole. Now in a hole so dark, can't see a thing, it's easy to lose sight of your goal. It's not the bullet, not the bullet that kills you, no, it's the hole, it's the hole, it's the hole. It's not the bullet, it's the hole.
Richard Roth, and this has been The Passage on WGXC. We heard Laurie Anderson with It's Not the Bullet, It's the Hole. And before that, Throbbing Gristle with Hamburger Lady. My guest today was Lucio Pozzi. This is Sarah Vaughan.
mentioned